Hello and welcome to Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au. Paul Barclay with you this evening. In a moment, we're off to the Gallery of Modern Art, GOMA, in Brisbane to examine the relationship between Indigenous art and politics. Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders make up at least a quarter, probably a half, of all working visual artists in Australia. They create more than 50% of the total value of Australian visual fine art and dominate the export market. Although the industry took a hit during the global financial crisis, sales are said to have picked up again. Figures are sketchy, but the Aboriginal art industry is estimated to make in excess of $200 million a year, with some putting the figure as high as $800 million. So we're talking about a substantial industry, and one with a fair degree of political influence, be it directly as political art, or indirectly as a platform for recognition and reputation. Tonight on Big Ideas, in the latest instalment in our GOMA Talks series, RN's Anthony Fennell explores this terrain with Bonnie Robertson, Professor of Indigenous Policy at Griffith University, contemporary artist Vernon R. Key, visual artist, festival director and journalist Jeremy Geyer, and author and academic Professor Peter Sutton, a social anthropologist and linguist at the South Australian Museum. He has tight connections to Indigenous communities in Cape York. This discussion was held in conjunction with the exhibition My Country, I Still Call Australia Home, Contemporary Art from Black Australia, at the GOMA in Brisbane. So let's hear what they have to say.
Bonnie Robertson, if I could start with you. This session is titled My Life. How central is art to the life and health of Indigenous Australia?
It's absolutely integral to our cultural identity, and I think it's... I'm not an artist myself, although I guess academia can be seen as a form of verbal art. I think art has become extremely important, not just in terms of our cultural identity and our protection of our cultural identity, but in the way our artists have been able to convey very critical messages in a much more palatable way than if they were doing it verbally. And so I think it's become very, very critical.
It seems to me often that mainstream Australia, there are almost two emblems that are put up of a modern Indigenous Australia. One of them on one side is the image, if you like, of the dysfunction of some remote communities. On the other is the success of Indigenous art. Is that a fair representation, do you think?
Well, I think there's a real disjointedness in the way art generally, Indigenous art generally, is conveyed internationally, the way it symbolically portrays to the rest of the world how this country respects and honours the foundations of our people being the first peoples of this country, and yet that same respect and symbolism isn't evident in the way our people are portrayed at the domestic level.
So it can be deceptive?
It is deceptive.
Vernon R. Key, bringing you in, do you agree with that? Is it sometimes deceptive? I mean, we look at how successful Aboriginal art, Indigenous art, has been within the Australian and international context, but does it sometimes paper over, if you like, the real issues that need to be addressed?
I think Australian culture and Australian history is a culture of deception, is a history of deception. Of course it is. You know, if we're talking about my life, Aboriginal life, from where I sit, that's what reads. I mean, particularly how Australia promotes itself internationally and uses Aborigines as a friendly kind of hook. You know, it's a lie. That's accurate and it's the nicest way to say it. But, you know, people get tricked into believing that Australia is a good country, and nothing Australia does demonstrates that.
I want to come to your specific art shortly, but I've got a broad question for you first of all. When we look at Indigenous art overall, how much of that is actually related to issues of cultural and identity, and how much of it is simply churned out for cash? I mean, there is an industry around particularly a lot of the traditional Aboriginal art, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know what you're asking, though. I mean, there's... The industry that's built up around art centres is different to the industry that's built up around blackfellas who toil away outside of art centres. There's two different questions there, and two different answers too. I mean, they both get rolled into Aboriginal art, but it's we're talking about, you know, pineapples and oranges here.
Is one, though, a problem for the other? You know, there is an Aboriginal art industry. Is that an issue for the way in which some within the Indigenous communities can tell their stories? Does it become more focused on pleasing an industry rather than actually connected to culture?
Absolutely. There's an industry that we call Aboriginal art, which is not created by Aboriginal people. It has not been informed in any level by Aboriginal people and is designed to cater for people who aren't Aboriginal. And that's obvious. It shouldn't need to be said, but it just needs to be said out loud. That's just the way it is, you know, and we still don't have any impact on that. So what happens is that, you know, we have maybe 80% of the Aboriginal population lives in urban centres and cities, but what we think of as Aboriginal art, when people talk about it, is they're talking about remote communities, we're talking about what we call traditional art, and that's probably less than 20% of the Aboriginal population actually subscribes to that,
yeah.
If they subscribe to it at all. But that's what it becomes the ideal. Now, when that ideal is preferenced or prefaced even, or just emphasised over the way we actually live our lives, it renders us all invisible. Always has done.
Now, you live in an urban environment. You do contemporary art. Is your art sometimes questioned over its Indigenous nature? I mean, do you face a situation where there is an expectation that you won't do contemporary art, that there is a certain type of traditional art that you must do in order to be considered as an Indigenous artist?
I think there's an idea that all Aboriginal people who make art make traditional art. There's an idea that that happens. It's become less so, but not much. If I walk outside of this building and people say, "What do you do?" and I say, "I make art," they think I make traditional art. And that's all. That still happens to me.
But it shouldn't be a matter of definition. How we define the way we do art shouldn't be determined whether this form of art is more valid than this form of art, or whether it makes you more Indigenous if you do this particular type of art as opposed to the other.
It shouldn't matter.
No, it shouldn't.
It shouldn't matter, but does it matter in terms of, say, trying to get a gallery interested in what you do? You know, not necessarily talking about the community recognising it as Indigenous, but are there these precepts, if you like, that say this is what you need to be for it, or this is what you need to paint or what you need to build in order for it to be considered Indigenous? Jeremy, let's bring you in. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the deception word was there and my ears pricked up straight away. I'd like to start off with a quote. You know, the smart way to keep people passive and obedient is to give them a limited spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within that spectrum. That's Noam Chomsky, right? So you're saying Indigenous art, you're saying Aboriginal art. These are English titles. I'm a non-Indigenous artist. Because if you look at the Black's Law Dictionary, the 9th edition, Indigenous, which stems from the word indigena, means a subject born into the English realm or naturalised by an act of Parliament. I'm neither of those things. I'm not a British subject. I'm not a vessel or a possession or a soldier for the Crown. I'm a Kuga Yimitha Prama, his grandfather and my grandmother, brother and sister. So that's the point here. You're talking about Aboriginal. These are constructs. These are European words, English titles. I don't really comment on the Aboriginal art industry because it's not my industry. I sell directly to people who are interested in my expressions, and those expressions are, you know, assertions of my sovereignty as a tribal man.
But you may not identify in that way, but that doesn't stop what goes on around from identifying people in that way, does it? That doesn't stop the broader society from still using those tags, regardless of whether you reject them or not.
Well, let's use a Roman maxim. Let he be deceived, be deceived. You know, if you're not going to go out there and do your due diligence as an artist or as a man or a woman and learn about your environment, you know, people, I think, artists have that inside their DNA. There's this innate thing that they are sovereign in this country and that this system does not belong to them. They're doing slave art if they identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, in my opinion only. I'm not saying that I represent the opinions of my clan or my tribe, but this is just me talking. So if people want to go walking around and saying they're a slave, and they will be treated as such in that box. I think a mate of mine and Vernon Richard Bell talks about the ethnographic treatment of blackfellas when it comes to art. You know, you've got to name your tribe, your totem, and talk about these pretty stories that go with it. Picasso didn't have to do that. Why should I have to do that?
Peter Sutton, like almost everything that deals with Indigenous issues, art is a difficult one, isn't it, to deal with? There are these complexities. On the one hand, mainstream Australia looks at Aboriginal art and says this is great, but as we've already heard, what are they looking at? What are they saying is great? And how valid is that form of art that they're specifically directing themselves towards? What have been the benefits, though, from art in Indigenous communities over the decades?
Can I just go back a step slightly, because I want to follow on from what Jeremy said, which I think is a vital point. When people get into this world of pigeonholes, Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal, ethnic, victim, etc., etc., as soon as you buy into group categories as at the forefront of who you are, and this is unavoidable for so many people, you have to take the rest of the deal. And the rest of the deal is, A, people won't agree about the categories. B, some people will think that you're using the category to get fame, recognition, respect, money, or whatever, rather than proving that you've got the goods as an individual. Because most of Indigenous affairs talk in this country is conducted in terms of the rather wobbly but still continuing frameworks of race and regionality, we're really reproducing, in a sense, the old internecine Catholics versus Protestants kind of universe that I was born into and which now no longer exists in this country. It just died. And it died with the belief system that was underpinning the sectarian stuff. It died with social mobility. It died with people like my father who couldn't get a job in a Catholic factory but could get a job in a Protestant factory. And the whole idea now seems ridiculous to us. I do think that the individual argument works best for contemporary artists of whatever background. I think it's more difficult for people who are in Arnhem Land or the Western Desert, where a much more corporate set of rights in the designs is played out.
And because that label that's then put there is that may not apply so much to contemporary artists. That's worth a lot of money, isn't it? That's worth a lot of profile for various people.
It is. And the it's true, the international view of Aboriginal art, I think, is probably still stuck where it was in 1988. We did our best in 1988 with a large-selling international catalogue that showed quite a bit of by people like Trevor Nichols and other contemporary non-Bush artists at the time. But the corrective there has to come through better representation of better work. One of the recognition problems, of course, from a great distance is if you're a Martian or someone living in New York, and I'm not sure about the distinction there, and you're looking at art in the Pacific or art in Australia or art in New Guinea, if you see dots or cross-hatching, there's a gestalt, you know, there's an immediate recognition, that's that lot. Mm. If you see a work by my two colleagues here who are practicing contemporary artists, which may not reference that kind of iconography or design pattern, from an international point of view, it's going to be, they'll see a jangle between the notion of Aboriginality and the notion of the design being free of dots and dashes. But within Australia, I do think there is and I think it's been a bit underestimated in this discussion so far, there is a growing audience of some sophistication. And I frankly don't give a damn what someone in the street thinks about this who doesn't have an interest in it and has no knowledge of it. I mean, their ignorance is their problem. And I don't think we're morally responsible for that, except to provide opportunity to get some understanding. Having free exhibitions like this magnificent one here, where anyone who has an interest and can get off their bike and come in can go there for nothing, that's fantastic. I mean, that's an aspect of a very fine society, in my view.
Bonnie Robertson, Australian Indigenous art is enormously popular around the world. I note that the former director of the Aboriginal Arts Board, Gary Foley, once said that the intense international interest created by Indigenous art rarely, though, translated into an appreciation of the historic and current injustices. Is he right?
I think I commenced my talk by saying that. I don't think that there's a parallel between the way this country has used Indigenous art on planes, on T-shirts and a whole range of other paraphernalia. I don't think that sense of national pride in what our Indigenous art represents internationally. I don't think that's translated back into the way it's rolled out in policy and recognition, in respect, back home. I just think there's a total disjointedness, and that's a real shame, because I think when international visitors come to this country thinking that there's going to be the same sorts of sentiments that they see on the planes, et cetera, rolled out in the streets, and then they come to Australia and see that that's not exactly the case, that you still have the Northern Territory intervention, you still have over-incarceration, all those terrible things that go along with being Indigenous in this country. There's a total disjointedness.
The expectations of people from overseas coming to Australia, you've talked about that, but in terms of gaining a greater knowledge of Indigenous culture and the issues that face it, it hasn't helped with people in various positions of authority around the world?
It's a tragedy when you have people coming to this country, either legally or illegally. When they come to this country and the first thing they ask, who are the Indigenous peoples? There's no real induction in terms in terms of who are. You go to Canada, you sit there, you go to, you know, all these other countries, and New Zealand. There's a process where people are still asking, who are the first peoples of this country? They know it's Aboriginal, but they don't know about our history. There's a lot of hidden history still. And the fact that Vernon said about the deception, our lives are based on deception, not our deception, but the country's deception about our existence.
So in a sense, we as a broader society in Australia, we cherry pick, do we, what we want to show of our Indigenous peoples, as opposed to, say, other countries like New Zealand being a good example, where it does seem like there is a greater intermeshing of Indigenous culture into some of the protocols of the society.
I think so, and I think when you have a country where there are still, after two or three decades of social policy that's supposed to be proactive, not reactive, where you still have the same social concerns, we have a very, very difficult situation in this country that gets right down to two things, deception and commodification. That's it.
Vernon, the reality is that we are all influenced by the structures around us, aren't we, whether we like them or not. It is hard to operate in a situation where you're not willing to look at the structures, good or bad, that affect you.
You summed up Aboriginal art, the kind of romanticised ideal that we're all familiar with, overly familiar with, does that. It ignores everything. It's expected to ignore everything. It's expected to portray a utopian ideal that no single Aborigine can possibly achieve or live up to. And that's what this country is comfortable with. So promoting Aboriginal art and this ideal, but not people.
What's the evidence for that?
Well, the fact that the romantic ideal is what's promoted internationally. That's what people expect to see, and are disappointed when they don't. Disappointment is one of the secondary responses after bafflement and befuddlement, because we're not primitive enough, because our lives are lives of sophistication and emotional depth and intelligence, and not this, you know, ever-narrowing idea of a Stone Age Aborigine, which is what those paintings outside on the wall represent. You know? And again, I shouldn't need to say it because it should be obvious, but I have to. In these sort of forums, I'm saying, having to repeat myself and say these same things over and over again, because people deny it. They deny that that's a representation, and that that representation is wildly set apart from our actual experience.
But even if that is the case, playing devil's advocate, are there not still benefits from that? I mean, is there not still a benefit from, say, the commoditisation in terms of employment, in terms of money, regardless of why it is there?
But it's the point of who benefits. I mean, of course there's benefits. I mean, we all have to live in a world where we feed our families, we have to make our way in the world, and of course there's benefits, but who benefits the most? If it's our art that's bringing in millions of dollars, and as some of the art does in the desert areas and other areas, and our people might get a very small percentage of that. If there's a whole industry out there that's built on the existence of our people in this country, and yet we're still impoverished, very, very low down on the employment scales. I mean, we all know the social indicators, so we shouldn't have to repeat them tonight. But, you know, so of course there's benefits, but at the end of the day, the question has to be asked, who benefits the most? And if it's built on our existence, wouldn't it be feasible to think that our people should have a far greater share of the spoils than what we're seeing at this point in time?
But you look so happy being poor. I just, you know.
Yeah, I am happy being poor.
So your thoughts on that, Jeremy?
Well, I think, you know, we've got to remember that most of the tribes on this continent had some sort of equitable system in place, and the consumer world is very patriarchal. I mean, you've got to look at that, and I think people are slowly getting to understand this monster on how to make a deal, how to market themselves, how to charge a little bit extra when, you know, you can, and smile about it and whatnot. The art for me is not about sales, you know. It's about, like I said before, it's me saying, you know what, we were here first and we are the original, we're not Aboriginal, you know. And again, I'm going to say another maxim, qui prior est tempore potior est jure, which means first in time is best in law. And if I keep painting that, that's going to remind everyone when I'm 500 years down the track and I'm being turned into a cryogenic orb floating around and talking to people, that's what I'll be saying. You know, like, this is the case. We were always here, we're the original sovereigns, and my artwork says that. It's not about money for me. It's really, really peaceful. But other people have, who want to be part of that other industry about money and all that kind of stuff, that's up to them to do it. They've got to feed their kids and all that kind of stuff. But for me, it's...
But should it be an either-or?
It's up to the... You know, I can't tell people what to think.
As somebody's tweeted saying, art opens up possibilities. Why are we focusing on patrolling its boundaries? A good point. Looking at the possibilities, what is it about, say, your art, Jeremy, that empowers your life? What do you fill that art with?
Well, when people see it, I'd like to think that they're interested in the story behind it, or makes them think, and the discussions that we need to have in this continent, that, you know, known to the Crown as Australia, is about who am I, where am I from, whose country am I living on, and what laws are around this place. I mean, it's more of a gentle approach rather than to me converting people with my tribal sovereign Bible or something like that. Art does break down those barriers, make people cry, you know, like I've heard about people seeing Rothko's work and this, that and the other, and, you know, it's changed their lives. And I don't think I'm going to do that, have that effect, but maybe one in a million, who knows, you know, you just don't know.
Is your art political? Is it always political?
Oh, you know, I was born here as a free man, and they try to enslave me, so it's very political, you know. I'm not a slave, I'm not a British subject. That's a political statement right there. And we are born into this planet, onto this planet rather, as free people. So it's a constant reminder. You know, we don't have blackfellas on stamps as much as the others do, or, you know, like, so I've got to create that. I made a poster called Diplomatic Incident. It was a Bollywood-style poster with my face on it and a lady in the crowd here. And the reason why I did it was because I don't have a multi-million dollar budget to make a movie that empowers blackfellas, but I made a poster, you know, and that was the whole point. You know, I was the main actor, and, you know, people ask me, why did you do that? I said, well, why not? You see what I mean?
Vernon, the political nature of art, all art is political. Is that true in your case?
There's an argument for it, but if all art is political, then... I mean, there's an idea. That's an idea that gets bandied around all the time. And that's okay. Whoever wants to subscribe to that position, fine. But the problem with me is that if the person is not a political person, if they don't have a political or, you know, a reactionary or radical bone in their body, then the art they make is not political.
But are you trying with the art that you make? I mean, I don't mean necessarily overtly political, but are you trying to tell stories that have political consequences in a sense?
A lot of the stories I make have political consequences only because I'm Aboriginal. But I don't go out of my way to make political art. I've made about half a dozen actual political works that were intentionally designed to have a political consequence. But I make work about my family and my people and about the events and historical impacts on my family, the things that have happened to me and my family, about my life. It's political, it's construed as political because it's often construed as oppositional. well, it's not construed as oppositional. It is. It demonstrates itself to be oppositional to what this country thinks of itself, so it's construed as political. But that's not my intention. I just want to make black fella strong, bring our people up.
And it wouldn't necessarily be seen as political if it was me doing it necessarily, would it? If I was doing paintings along the same themes.
If you're producing portraits, large-scale, monumental portraits that made heroes out of your uncles and your grandfathers, no one would bat an eyelid.
Mm. Can I come in there?
Sure, Peter.
I think this is on an important area. The sophisticated international urban art world has, for a long time, had a good chuckle at the political art of Russia in the 30s or the political art of China in the 60s. It's been ridiculed, in fact, as being kind of weird and stylized and sort of lacking a love for something. So it's a really tough game to do political art, I think, in, you know, given that kind of reaction and the history of the emphasis on aesthetic beauty in the Western art tradition, and in fact, let's face it, most art traditions, which have commented on themselves. So I do think it's a tough call, and so you've got an audience out there where they can get very tired very quickly of art that is in their face, political, constantly. So the mix that's around in, I think, in Vernon's work is the sort of mix that means that the audience that might have got tired are not going to get so tired. They may well know their history, they may well be totally sympathetic and full bottle on the history. They may have personally known dozens of people who were removed from their families, as people like me do, who worked with them 30, 40 years ago. And they do not like being preached at on subjects about which they're highly aware. So there's a problem there with communicating a message. The sort of issues that came up in the 1970s in theatre and opera and at the Adelaide Festival, when plays were about heroic working class struggles and other subjects that are slightly pasticheable now, and that really put audiences off. So I think to penetrate a wider audience, some subtlety, some mixture, some Holocaust history, if you want to extend that metaphor, but where's the humanity of that individual who made that? Do they share a love of something with me? Many people do. And art shouldn't all be about accusation. It should be about history, in which there'll be accusations, but it also needs to, in my view, in order to be art rather than simply banner waving, it needs to have an element of love for something.
Jeremy, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I remember someone buying one of my first works was called Skeleton Creek because they liked the look of it, and I told them the story behind it. I said, well, this depicts the 16 tribal warriors that were beheaded just outside of Cairns. They were shocked, and they didn't want it in their house. I said, no, it's fine. It's, you know, it's a story. It's from that area, and you're very lucky because no one else has painted that story. It's the first time that that tribe in Cairns, the Yidinji people, told me that story, and they gave me permission to paint it. So it's you know, these are stories, and the documentation that could be construed as political. You know, I think for me anyway, my art is political because I express my sovereignty, like I said, and I tell. As a journo, my tools were the words, right? So, but I'm still a storyteller, so I paint the stories now.
But are you, in that sense, are you painting that to shock, to have an impact, or are you painting something that resonates with you about your experience, about your history? Or the two. I mean, it can be the two, can't it?
Yeah, well, it's telling the stories that aren't being told in the mainstream press, you know? Like, it's hard to, you know, the average bloke and lady gets about 2,000 to 3,000 impressions of commercials and adverts in a day. You know, how are you supposed to compete with stuff like that when they're being massaged by mass media and to a certain extent the education system, the tools of indoctrination? So I have to compete against that by saying, well, these are the stories that affect me, and if people have a human connection with me, hopefully they'll subscribe to some of the stories and they don't have to agree with them or whatnot, but it's something different for them to take on board.
So it's a two-way connection, not a preaching
absolutely.
One way straight.
You know, the worst religion is the one that, you know, that tells you what to do and how to think.
Yeah. Bonnie, your thoughts?
You know, I was sitting here thinking that it doesn't matter whether it's an art form or a dance, a song or a lecture. Everything that we do, whether we intend it or not, has a political connotation to it. Mm. Everything that we do. It doesn't matter. There's always somebody out there who will perceive it in that way. I think generally, and this might be from a point of ignorance, although I don't think it is, I think people find art that has a political message to it much more palatable to take than if I set up and gave a lecture on the massacres, for example, across Queensland, because in some ways they can distance themselves from that. They can look at a piece of art and think, well, that's really nice, that's how that artist sees it, or that's how that artist might express it. But if you're standing in a lecture and you're talking about the number of massacres that took place across a particular area, then that's, for some reason, is seen to be less palatable than if it's done in an art form. So I think all sorts of expression from our people does have a political connotation to it, whether we like it or not.
Bonnie Robertson, Professor of Indigenous Policy at Griffith University, artist Vernon R. Key, Jeremy Geyer, visual artist, festival director and journalist, and author, academic and social anthropologist Peter Sutton. They're all in conversation with RN's Anthony Fennell. You're with Big Ideas on RN and online at abc.net.au. Tonight, we're exploring the links between Indigenous art and politics. You may have noticed that a lot of Indigenous art has a strong political intention, a clear message. But how do current policies play out for Indigenous communities and artists? Let's head back to this Goma Talks discussion in Brisbane.
Vernon, what's the power of contemporary art? When you look at the vast array, say in this exhibition, of art, what power speaks to you through that?
I enjoy that we are in an era in art where art is very much about ideas, and ideas fuel art. You know, if you can draw, then you're a good drawer. If you can come up with good ideas and can't underpin those ideas with good skill and discipline, then you have a good idea. But if you mesh the two, a good idea with good skill, with good discipline and preparedness and think something through, you are capable of producing an artwork that is good.
Jeremy, the art shapes politics, but politics in turn shapes art, doesn't it? And there is a lot of bureaucracy through the Australia Council, through various arts bodies, arts funding bodies in Australia, specifically around Indigenous art. How has that affected the way in which artists in Australia operate?
Well, I don't know what every artist in Australia thinks about that, but all I can say is that I would be apprehensive to fill out an Aboriginality form because I'm not Aboriginal. So that one thing is I probably can't get Australia Council money. So everything I've done, well, Belgium and, you know, last year in Cairns, and it's off my own back. So that's, you know, very difficult. But at the same time, this is what most Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander organisations, or those who identify as those organisations, you know, there is a financial joinder. And yes, it's going, when it's going good, it's going good. But if you did something that upsets a regime or some government official or that isn't in the best, you know, it's a bit political or whatever, and those, you know, those budgets and that go down. You see that with the universities, you see that with lots of different things. So how happy blackfella do I have to play to get that money and make things happen? And what does someone like, you know, Richard Bell, which is, you know, hats off to him, he's done brilliantly by going the other direction and doing things like that. It's very difficult because I don't immerse myself in that particular area of grant.
This is a problem for the whole society on a wider subject, and this goes way beyond what we're here to talk about in a way, but I think it's symptomatic in this domain as well, which is that in my lifetime I've seen the country go from being one with a fair bit of law and regulation, sometimes over-regulation, but huge areas of informality, amateurism, unpaid work and all the rest of it. An artist when I was a boy was someone who was probably, who believed in free love, drank red wine and was a communist and lived at Eltham, just out of Melbourne. Nobody funded them. They didn't, if they did, they were private buyers of their works and they didn't have two bob to rub together, basically. Huge amounts of this society have now become increasingly made complex by increasing layers of protocols, rules, boundaries that weren't there before. It's increasingly looking more and more like a kind of voluntary totalitarian state. I don't want to live in that kind of country. I think we need to move back to much more informality and much more swaggydom, if you like, because we're all paid to subject ourselves to the needs of organisation and control, and this issue of control did come up a bit earlier. that people are controlled by a voluntary membership of what is really going to eat us all in the end if we don't stick up for the freedom of people who are not necessarily going to be conformists.
Bonnie, I'd like to get your thoughts on that in a second. Jeremy, did you want to just jump in again?
I'm sorry, I do have a good example of that. With my hat on with the Laura Dance Festival, I remember a few years ago these fresh bureaucrats from Brisbane and elsewhere coming down, and you know, they didn't know who I was, and well, that I'm a bit of a clown sometimes, you know. But I said, look, you know, we really need, X amount of dollars, like $90,000 to $100,000, and you know, everyone was a bit tight. And I said, we don't want to sell alcohol at the festival because we can make a lot of money through that, but we don't want to do it. And then, money came out of everywhere. So you use politics, you know, to create that thing, and you got to be a bit political as well. You know what I mean? Mm. So pressing the buttons and knowing how to use that in art in itself. So, you know, there are times when you use those tactics.
Bonnie, your input? I mean, does the bureaucracy, or what part does the bureaucracy play? Does it play a limiting role at times?
I think just living in society today is political. I mean, everything we do is prefaced on, you know, a political agenda. But for our people, I think that there's a degree of fluidity there where our existence rests on the whims of a political agenda that has often nothing to do with our existence, but what somebody in Canberra might have deemed to be appropriate for our existence. And so I think that there definitely needs to be more of a closer synergy between what is said in politics and how it's panned out in policy for our people. And for example, if you think about it, in the last two or three decades, we've had a number of milestones where we've had the Redfern apology, we had the apology by Mr. Rudd, only to roll out a whole spectrum of processes that demeaned our people, denied our people human rights, imposed a regime upon our people that certainly didn't do anything about restoring and building. It was actually quite demeaning and demoralising.
It was an apology without reservation.
Absolutely.
If you read his apology,
yeah.
Can I just say that?
With a reservation. You know, the day we see a politician, regardless of what political persuasion, stand up and let their words roll out in a more proactive, restorative type of policy for our people, I think we will see a change. Other than that, our lives are just based on a fluid movement of Chinese checkers within politics.
And there does seem to be, doesn't there? Correct me if I'm wrong. There does seem to be a lot of symbolism that goes on. There's a lot of political energy.
Yep.
Around symbolism.
Yeah.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. I mean, what was your feeling when the whole notion of a constitutional preamble about Indigenous Australians was a political issue, agreed with in a bipartisan way, but then ditched or at least parked to the side as soon as the election campaign came on?
Honestly, I think we've got to get beyond the symbolism. I can't stand it when our lives are directed by the goodwill of a politician or a political party at one point, and then abrogated in terms of their responsibilities of measuring that and taking it out and being able to evidence some sort of change and impact on our lives in a positive way. That's not there. So I just get tired of it. And I think our whole existence in this country, in this goddamn country, is about politics. Every day there is something that is decided upon outside of our existence, and they select people to represent us outside of our input to determine a whole range of things that are going to influence how we're seen, how we're perceived, you know, the future of our people, the past of our people. It's all determined by a political whim and some form of symbolism that has nothing to do with the practical application of that particular type of symbolism in our lives.
And that idea of, I'm just staying with that idea of selecting people. I mean, it is one of the things, isn't it, Peter Sutton, that happens quite often in Australian political discourse when we're looking at Indigenous affairs. Our politicians, our parties, our governments select various people that they will talk to on behalf of, or they champion those people on behalf of Aboriginal people. And we could probably all come up with a handful of names now. How difficult is that, though, for actually getting progress on Indigenous issues overall?
Well, it's a clash between a very egalitarian society in terms of its long past and one that arrived with a very hierarchical set of delegations upwards. So, in other words, people could speak for others in Britain. as indeed they could in Tonga, as indeed they could in New Zealand, because they had stratified societies, they had permanent hill forts, they had to have stratified power. That is, some people could boss other people around and expect them to behave. When you've got a very, very egalitarian society, where the refrain that you'll hear from lots of old people and even young people is, nobody boss for me, I'm boss myself. He can't talk for me, he's from a different country. I talk from my place. That's the deep philosophical and genuinely based clash between what you might call the culture of representativity, which is the global one, which makes car factories work and makes armies work, makes Catholic churches work sometimes, as against a society where there's an enormous reliance on self-redress and self-preservation and so on. So yes, there is the problem of the king plate phenomenon, which was the colonial thing which began in the 18th century, I think, in Sydney, of government selecting particular Aboriginal people of some prominence and granting them a king plate. There was one for every bay up in eastern Cape York Peninsula, a king plate for Barrow Point, a king plate for Flinders Island, a king plate for Port Stewart, handed out to particular men, always men, I think. Sometimes the women got them as Queen Gooseberry, for example, in Sydney.
And we're still doing it?
Well, it's collusive. Okay. Don't say we're doing it. We're all doing it. It takes two to tango.
Indeed.
And that's the problem.
Jeremy, your experience on this, because as somebody who has been there only just recently, you're not covering politics anymore, but the fact that you were covering politics in Canberra for NITV,
yes.
What were your impressions of the process? How did the process that you saw enacted in front of you, how did that leave you?
Well, Parliament, if you look at the word Parliament, parler, which means to talk or speak in French, mentire in Latin means to lie. So if you trust people in a place where it says talk to lie, then you need your head scanned. And when they say it's an act of Parliament, it's all a charade. I would ask serious questions about the dire situation and what are the solutions to dealing with, you know, getting people out bush and, you know, jobs and all that kind of stuff. Wayne Swan or whoever it was would just go back to this cue sheet, we're trying to close the gap and, you know, we're getting there and it's going to take years and years and years. And that was it. So that's all they had to say, you know, in between the blood bath and the, you know, sharpening knives and all that kind of stuff. And who knows, it might change, but I think...
So was that a reason for your departure? Did you leave because you were fed up with it?
Well, to a certain extent, but I did enjoy it. I mean, it is comical, you know. There's a sort of a schadenfreude, you know, sort of sitting there and just watching people, the suicide bomber, you know, what's his name, Simon Crean, you know. That's why I ran into one of the senators' room and said, we've got a suicide bomber in Parliament, you know. It is a bit like that. There's some good people with good intentions, don't get me wrong, but I think it just gets lost in all of that Crown Corporation activity.
Bonnie Robertson, this past federal campaign, we had a record number of Indigenous candidates, but we still don't see a fair representation within our parliaments of Indigenous people.
Yeah.
How do we address that?
There's quite a number of ways, and, you know, there's been a whole movement in the last decade, both within politics and within our own communities, to come up with some solutions. But one of the things that I think is absolutely critical is that we have to work very hard to help our people gain faith in the political system again in this country. I think a lot of our people have lost faith, not only in the political system, but in the people who represent us, and that's black and white. I think they've lost faith in the honesty of this country. I think they've lost faith in the true meaning of reconciliation, social justice, and that Closing the Gap campaign that Jeremy just spoke about. I think that one of the critical things we have to do is to help our people regain our faith.
The Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, has moved Indigenous Affairs under the umbrella of his department. I mean, there will still be an Indigenous Affairs Minister in Nigel Scullion from the Northern Territory, but he's putting Indigenous Affairs under the auspices of Prime Minister and Cabinet. And I've got a quote here from him. He said, "It is my hope that I could be not just a Prime Minister, but a Prime Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, the first, I imagine, that we have ever had."
I think it's too early to determine whether there's true validity in those words, and I hope Mr. Abbott does follow through. I think it's admirable that he's put himself up as the first Prime Minister to do that. But once again, There's a process that's been put in place, he says, this on one hand, and on the other hand, determines who's going to represent us without allowing us as Indigenous peoples in this country to determine who it is that we want to represent us. So on one hand, he's saying, I'm going to do things differently, I'm going to be the Prime Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, and then resorts back to the same old, same old. So there's a little bit of a disjointedness in the philosophy and the practice.
Vernon, your thoughts on the changing political scene?
I just think that he assumed the portfolio of Aboriginal Affairs, so that the portfolio of Aboriginal Affairs is absolutely not accountable to anybody. That's all. Now, I mean, I don't think it's worth talking about Tony Abbott. but again, going back to the apology, it's the apology we're all thinking about. But I don't know what he was apologising for. This is still stumps me. I don't know what he was apologising for. I would like anybody to actually tell me what he was apologising for.
In what sense? In what sense? What do you mean by that?
Because I don't know, particularly since it truly meant nothing. And it has meant nothing since, because the status quo is still the same. And in case we weren't watching, we just had a federal election where it just got worse. So I don't know what that apology did.
So hollow symbolism.
I'm not sure what it changed, right? We just got asked to swallow the wafer again, right?
This is engineering at its ultimate best and brilliance. You got John Howard coming up with a reconciliation in Australia, and in court of law, reconciliation wipes out injury. So if you wipe out an injury or debt, then you do not owe the person or the man or woman you've injured any money. So to apologise, you've massaged the whole, you've taken Australia, you know, you sold them a dummy, and you've created this whole atmosphere about, oh, you know, I'm sorry, brother, sister, you know.
We swallowed the wafer.
It's an apology with reservation. It's not an apology.
Well, the authorities who were responsible.
More than anything, it was an act of appeasement. People felt appeased that we could say as a country we did
the
right
situation
thing. But that right thing, only a few days later, a few months later, the whole welfare reform was rolled out. So there's that lack of synergy between the philosophy and the practice.
Now, I just want to, because we're fast running out of time, we've got to close up in a second, but I do want to bring in the political experience before we leave of the Northern Territory, what's happened there in the last year or so. Because as most people would know, or maybe they don't, Indigenous people have an enormous presence in the Northern Territory. It is only a small jurisdiction, but they're a significant voting bloc. When I lived up there 15 years or so ago, people would often talk about at election times about the Labor Party up there taking Indigenous people for granted. And the call was, when will this bloc get together and vote for their own interests? Now, the Indigenous vote was widely seen as putting the CLP government in power last year. Do you think it was that important, and how relevant is what's gone on up there? Is it a sign of a more coordinated approach to politics from Indigenous people?
I think in the next little while, this country will be very, very surprised to see the degree of mobilisation that's taking place amongst our people. We're not, you know, silently sitting back, allowing politics to play, you know, shotgun with our lives. There is a mobilisation going on. I think that gaining that faith that I was talking about, re-energising our people to have confidence in the political system, to know that our people can actually contribute to a political system so that our own people can have a voice. I think in the next little while, some of our own people, will be shocked with the level of mobilisation.
Let's briefly just end off on the thoughts of the other panellists on that. Vernon?
I don't think so.
The Northern Territory is very different, isn't it, from the experience that most
Indigenous people experience. It's convenient to bring up the Northern Territory because it's different. They're governed differently. The mindset is different there. We all know that. You know, it's no accident that the intervention is being trialled there because they can. That's the reason. Again, we're asked to swallow that wafer. Black communities have always been used to experiment on. And that's okay while it stays within black communities. And you only gain traction when it becomes an issue, when that treatment of a group of people spreads outside of that community. and affects the wider society. You know, we're all complicit in the intervention. There's not enough people who vocally stand up and say, it's a bad idea, you shouldn't do this, it's against human rights.
By 2050, population experts have forecast that North Australia will be more than 50% blackfellas. Currently, more than 50% of blackfellas old enough to vote aren't even enrolled, so there's a bit of a situation there. For me, it's pay television. You're paying television out of your own money. You've got Channel 1, Coalition, Channel 2, Labor. Oh, I've got the Pirate Party TV. Thanks very much. And that's it. It's a very limited political system. That's why when the Australian Electoral Commission wrote to me and said, please explain your apparent failure to vote, I wrote back in my grandmother's language, and I could see it going up to this SES, to the commissioner, and back down again. Could you write in English? I didn't write back.
Now, we'll come back to you in a second, Vernon, just to end. Thank you for that, Jeremy.
You're right.
Peter, let's get your thoughts.
If there's more Indigenous representation in the parliaments, I'll predict now that that a fair proportion, if not the majority, will be from the Conservative side of politics, based on the past experience. Eric Dirrell, member for in Queensland, the one from Palm Island.
Bonner.
Neville Bonner, again, Conservative. Ernie Bridge, not sure. Was he Labor in WA?
Labor.
Okay, but there are currently a number of Conservative parliamentarians in the Northern Territory along with Labor.
And why do you think that is?
It's fatal in politics to make a complacent assumption about your constituents, to take them for granted, as the term has been used, and to think you know what's right for them. If Australia's population stabilises, roughly, given enough time, the majority of Australian people will be of Aboriginal ancestry. What year that happens in, I don't know. But if the population doesn't grow enormously from now on, given the massive out-marriage rate of Aboriginal people to non-Aboriginal people, you'll end up with maybe 60% and then perhaps growing beyond that Indigenous in this country. I think we need to think ahead to that world and think about how to bring up our kids and grandchildren in the world that is going to prepare for that.
And Vernon, coming back to you just to take us out.
I think that's a long way off. I reckon what will happen is you'll have an apology apologising for doing nothing. I think in 20 years we'll have an apology for doing nothing for the last 20 years, and then 20 years after that you'll have the same thing again. The problem with this country is that this country has still to come to terms with accepting Aboriginal people as a fully realised people, fully realised humans. And until that happens, we won't get anywhere. We were not recognised. The reason is because of the doctrine of terra nullius, and where we were made invalid as a human species. And it allowed for any number of horrors to be, you know, committed against us, on us. And that's still happening. And again, I shouldn't need to say that, but the intervention is evidence enough, I think.
All right, we'll have to leave it on that point. So let's give them all a round of applause.
The presenter of RN's Future Tense, Anthony Fennell, talking Indigenous art and politics with Bonnie Robertson, Professor of Indigenous Policy at Griffith University, artist Vernon R. Key, Jeremy Geyer, artist, festival director and journalist, and Professor Peter Sutton, who's a social anthropologist and linguist at the South Australian Museum.
The approval of the $700 billion package caps 2 weeks of turmoil in Washington and on Wall Street.
5 years ago, the US government saved its banking system from collapse.
This is an essential short-term measure to ensure the viability of America's banking system.
Join me, Keri Phillips, for Rear Vision and Beyond the Bank Bailout. And you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.